History often moves slowly, almost imperceptibly. But sometimes, the world is forever changed by a single, brutal act of violence. Assassins tells the story set in these moments of chaos and fire. I'm Aslan Pahari, and on my new show, Assassins, I'll bring you the stories of assassinations that change the course of history. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Michelle Payne grew up as the youngest in a big family. It was one that knew real tragedy, but was knitted together with love and hard work, along with an abiding passion for horses and horse racing. At 15, Michelle won her first horse race in Ballarat, and 15 years later, she became the first woman to win the biggest horse race in Australia, the Melbourne Cup. Michelle's beloved brother Stevie was her strapper that day, and Stevie was especially happy because, against all the odds, he'd bet on her to win. Talking to reporters right after the race, Michelle thanked her team and told all the chauvinists in racing who'd stood in her way to get stuffed. What followed in the days, weeks and months after Michelle's Melbourne Cup win was a whole other kind of whirlwind. There were adoring fans, red carpet events, dinner with Charles and Camilla, a ticker tape parade in Ballarat. She and Stevie were even crowned Queen and King of Moomba. All that celebration was in turn followed by a devastating injury and more family heartbreak. But if there is one thing Michelle Payne knows a lot about, it's how to get back up. Her new book is called Ride On. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Sarah.
Let's start with your dad, Paddy. Whereabouts did he grow up?
He was brought up in Taranaki in New Zealand. He fell in love with horses, not necessarily, wasn't from a horsing family, but more cattle, but he just found a real knack with them.
How did he get his start with horses? What was he doing as a young bloke with horses?
I think just he was a bit of a larrikin, having a good time, and I think it was at a rodeo. Then he got into jumps racing, which in New Zealand is very good, and became quite successful. Even though he was amateur, he did really well with some, you know, very cheap, not fancied horses, and felt he had a real knack working with them.
He took off to Europe as a young bloke. What sort of adventures did he get up to over there?
Travelled across on a ship, worked his way over there, didn't have any money. Just worked around riding horses and having a great time in his 20s. I remember him telling me when I travelled a lot as a young rider throughout my 20s, trying to explore the world sort of through the winter time, taking a break from riding. He said to me, "You should be staying home, saving your money." And I looked at him, I was like, "You're not preaching, you know, how you lived or what you did." He sort of travelled until he was in his sort of late 20s, 30, came back to New Zealand, met my mum. Didn't have a cent to his name.
Where did he and your mum first meet?
They had met before he went on his travels. And funnily enough, she said to him, "You're not settled enough." And she ended it. So good on her. She realised that he needed to go and live. So he did that. He came back from his travels and ran into my mum's brother. And he said, "Oh, you should write to Mary, my mum." And he did that. And they met up at a dance. And she must have thought, well, he's more settled now. And
some of the edges have been rubbed off.
Exactly. Yeah. Accepted him back.
Her family had come out to New Zealand when she was a teenager.
Yeah. So she was 15 and they were living in Switzerland, from Switzerland. Spoke no English, but heard of this, you know, these amazing opportunities of farming in New Zealand, and they were farmers over in Switzerland. So it's a pretty gutsy move. They had 8 children, shipped everybody out, and as I said, no one spoke English. So they showed up at school. They changed my mum's name from Rosa to Mary. So yeah, never know whether to call her Rosa or Mary because Dad changes all the time as well. I think Mum was a good-looking lady and Dad was a good-looking guy, so they met up and, eventually, after the 5 years interim in between times, you know, really hit it off, and wasn't their intention, I don't think. They ended up having 11 children. One of my brothers passed away as a baby, to have that many kids, but good Catholics. And my dad said, yeah, that wasn't the intention, but they went on the rhythm method. And
is that old joke? What do you call people who use the rhythm method? Parents. So how did a horse race help set your mum and dad up after they'd got married?
So my dad was dairy farming, and they had, I think it was the first four children. He bought a young horse, I think back then was for $1,300, and they named him Our Paddy Boy. Our Paddy Boy became a champion in New Zealand, ended up, you know, being good enough to ship over to Australia and become Australasian Horse of the Year, and a champion two-year-old, was then, you know, very successful as a three-year-old, and my dad sold him for a lot of money. And that basically set them up for buying a really good place in Australia and settled in Ballarat, which was suggested to them as a town that was very similar to New Zealand, what they were used to. And we're happy about it. It's a beautiful town, but it is pretty chilly. So times we're like thinking back to the
Queensland,
person who suggested
the Gold Coast,
it.
Lots yeah. of places you could have settled, mum and dad. So your family came over here and had a bunch more kids, including you, right at the end there. And looking after a farm as well as 10 kids, your mum must have had her arms full. I mean, it's kind of unimaginable how she managed all of that.
Honestly, I don't know. What a woman. And my dad said she did all of the bookkeeping. She would cook and clean, all the washing. They had a cow. She used to milk the cow for milk. And then anything left over, which I don't know how there was left over with 10 children, she'd take it into the men's homeless shelter and just make sure it didn't go to waste. So unbelievable. My sister tells me, like, she would make a cake and with 10 kids it would be gone in 2 minutes. But she would just be so happy that everybody was happy. And, yeah, what a remarkable woman.
What happened in your family, Michelle, when you were just 6 months old?
So I don't remember. Obviously being told the story, but my dad was set to take the children to school. That day it was his turn. He got stuck on a phone call, so she signalled to Dad, I'll take them. And this day there was only four in the car because it was a race day at Ballarat. So one of my sisters had got out of school. She was going to the races. Therese was riding that day. She was a jockey at that stage, the second eldest. Andrew had convinced Mum that he didn't want to go because he was having a bad day, and he was, I think, six at the time, and said, you know, you never read with me at school and all the other mums do. And she said, I'll read with you next time. But, yeah, there was just four in the car this day. And, yeah, on the way in there, another mother driving her children to school just misjudged that she was coming, and, yeah, hit the driver's side and killed her instantly.
And your dad was then suddenly a widower with 10 kids to care for. I imagine that other people must have suggested that, you know, he'd let some of you go and live with other families. Was that ever a possibility?
I don't know how he would have even thought about what he was going to do, but I think once he had time to sit down and think about it, he thought it was better we all stuck together. I was still breastfeeding, so I was worried about that. But, you know, put me straight onto a bottle, and luckily that was no problem. So it was one less of a worry. And, yeah, he just relied on the kids that he'd raised to help. And honestly, they are just amazing.
How did they step in and help look after you?
One thing that blows me away is that they were children themselves, sort of 16 and younger. And I just think it's adorable that they just, you know, took over the role, made sure the washing was done, everything was cleaned. I don't think we ate as well when Mum passed away, but we survived, really. And, you know, I was recently asked for a photo at primary school, and I was in grade prep and grade one, and beautifully dressed, had nice little frilly socks on, new shoes and hair done with the scrunchie and, you know, all matching, and told to stand up straight and hold my hands well. And I just think that is so gorgeous that they were so young themselves but knew all the principles that they'd been taught. So, you know, I really take a lot away from that.
What about your sister Margie? What responsibility did she take on?
A really gorgeous memory that I have of my older sister, Margie. She's about 9 years older than me. So when I got to about six or seven, just we were sitting around in one of the bedrooms, and she said, has anybody been reading to you at night time? And I was like, oh, no. And she's like, oh, let me read to you. And I was felt so special. So anyway, she only did it for two nights because she got busy and forgot. But I just remember it so clearly, how gorgeous that she recognised it. And I just appreciated it so much. But it's amazing. Like, I didn't obviously get much attention with that kind of thing, but you learn and you go to school, and I wasn't behind. Dad did a lot of things with us. He tried to teach us as best he could all together because he didn't have time to help each one with their homework, but he'd do like spelling competitions. Everybody would get a pen and paper. He'd pick out words out of a newspaper or anywhere and just start the competition. Everybody would sit down, do the words, and at the end correct and who won. You know, it was just a really exciting.
The youngest ever get a chance with that.
But you learned.
The odds are stacked against you there. More than the Melbourne Cup.
Exactly. You learned your place pretty early and you were just happy to get a few. But I think that's gorgeous, you know, having 10 kids, and wasn't just that. He'd do maths competitions, geography. He loved it, and we loved it too. So it was a really nice way as a family to connect.
In some families, when there's a really terrible loss like that, the person who's died is like never mentioned again. You know, photos are put away and it's like they almost never existed. Was it like that with your family after the loss of your mum?
It's interesting you say that because, as I said, my dad is a different character. He, I think, found comfort in talking to me about her. And I remember, as young as I can remember, sort of 4 years old and onwards, he would talk about it every day. And I think he wanted me to feel her presence and feel her around. And I just, I think that's beautiful.
So she was part of your life as well through the way he spoke about her.
Exactly. She wasn't forgotten. My older brothers and sisters didn't talk about mum a lot. I think it was very painful for them, obviously. But it was really nice that he did, and he still kept a really good sense of faith around the house. We'd always stop to say the rosary or Hail Marys. You know, he made sure that we had good faith ourselves, and I think that's really helped us through some tough times.
You were closest in age to your brother Stevie. What would the two of you do together as kids? What do you remember?
Oh my God, we were just, honestly, it was. We were surviving growing up. We were out doing anything and anywhere we wanted, playing with things and learning. And we obviously had so many kids around. They generally knew where we were, keeping an eye on us without keeping an eye on us. And, yeah, we would just play games. We would play cards together. We'd watch and learn off the older kids. And obviously Stevie was Down syndrome, so it took a little bit longer to learn the games. But he was very smart. He'd pick it up. And obviously I didn't know any different either, being younger than him. So I would just learn with him and teach him the games. And maybe sometimes I'd start with the pack and give him one card to start with in certain games. And then eventually we'd go a few more cards. And then now we're on an even playing field. Like, he's honestly unbelievable. We bring people to our place to play board games and stuff, and they're like, he's not even Down syndrome, this guy's just pretending.
How did horses respond to Stevie?
Amazingly. Like, I think the most beautiful thing about horses is their intelligence, you know, their receptors. They're like a dog, but even more intuitive to reading you and your personality and how you feel. And I think especially thoroughbreds, who we obviously work with in the racing industry. So they just love him. It's you have to see it with your own eyes to believe it, how calm they are around him and the effect that he has on them.
Is it because, do you think, they sense something in him? Like, what can they tell about Stevie, those horses?
There's just no bluffing him and no bluff from him. They just don't feel, I think, any threat in any way. If I can't catch a horse for some reason or another, you know, we might have had to catch a horse and put some shoes on it and wasn't happy about it, they'll remember. If I send Stevie in there, they just wander up and let him catch him straight away. It's really unbelievable. You have to see it to believe it.
Now, horses are such huge animals, Michelle. Were you ever scared of them as a little kid?
Probably because I was around them from as young as I can remember. Not at all. There were times where I got really badly injured from like as young as sort of 6 or 7 coming off them. But I think my dad had sort of taught me from even younger than that. As a 4-year-old, I fell off our pony and knocked my head. And he's like, you have to get straight back on or you won't get on again. And I was like, okay, I didn't really want to at the time. I had a headache. But I just remembered him saying that, and each time I fell off, I thought, well, I've got to get back on, and probably just was ingrained into me after that. And a lot of the time, you know, when there was an incident, it was just through one reason or another that you could learn from. And I sort of saw it in that perspective rather than how big and grand they actually are.
How did your dad talk to horses? What do you remember observing about the way he interacted with them?
His interaction with them is about being kind, but also having the respect. If you don't have the respect of a 500 or 600 kilo animal, they'll just walk all over you and bowl you over. And they're very smart. As kind as they are, they also know if they can be the boss or take advantage of a situation. So that's what he really taught us as horsemen. Earn their trust, earn their respect, and you're working with them will be so much more easier and enjoyable.
Are they naturally curious animals, horses?
Definitely, yeah. Like if you're just in a paddock and even if you can't catch a horse and it's running around, if you just go over to the fence and start building something or doing something, eventually the curiosity gets the best of them. They'll come over and let you catch them. They're just, you know, they're gorgeous in the fact that they are so inquisitive, and I guess that's what makes them just so different as an animal. Like their intuition and personalities are just really incredible.
What did your dad think about girls racing, about girls being jockeys?
From my experience with him, he grew up, the first four children were girls. Therese and Bridget were the eldest two, and they rode on the dairy farm in New Zealand from as young as sort of 10, 11, absolutely loved it. And I think Dad loved teaching them. They used to ride our paddy boy, who was a colt and, you know, big and strong. And Bridget used to just ride him with no fuss, take him to the races as an 11, 12-year-old girl into the mounting yard, strapping him. Nowadays, you know, you have to be at least 15 to be allowed to gain a strapper's license. So I think he really gained respect that women couldn't be treated any different as a guy in the industry. And New Zealand was a bit different in the fact that they didn't see too much of a difference between their male and female riders. And for many years, the girls were absolutely thriving in New Zealand racing. And the first couple of riders to come out and ride in the Melbourne Cup were Kiwi girls. So Dad's personality was, you know, the girls are as good as the boys. They just need the opportunities, and used to say those words walking around the house. And I was 4, 5, 6 years old listening to that and onwards, and didn't think anything different. Just felt that that was how it was, and never looked back.
It can, of course, be a very dangerous profession, as your family know really well. Your older sister, Bridget, who was a real trailblazer for women jockeys, she died in 2007 after a heart attack and a series of aneurysms following on from a number of bad falls while she was racing. Did her death make you think twice at all about continuing as a jockey?
No, it didn't. Back then I was 21 and had a fractured skull myself, and had some damage to the brain and a bleed on the brain, and it was really frightening, but I made a really full recovery and was going well. So you just have to take each case as it is. And Bridgie had a very tough life after Mum passed away, being the eldest, 16 years old. As any teenagers do, they fight with their mum and dad, and I think she probably took it the hardest and took the brunt of it. So from then on, she had a troubled life. She left home as a 16-year-old. She had a son, Sam, at 24, come back home. And I was really happy we got to spend time together because I didn't know her until then. But, yeah, it was just one of those things that I think she maybe didn't look after herself as well as she could have with the fall, so I didn't relate it to a horse racing incident. And as tragic as it was, you just have to take every case on their merits.
You started your apprenticeship, your formal apprenticeship as a jockey at 14. How does an apprentice jockey spend their days?
Basically working from dusk until dawn. But you're doing something that you're so passionate and excited and just can't wait to get better and gain more opportunities. In the mornings, you're up early, you're feeding the horses, you're working them, you're cleaning out the boxes, filling up waters, you're giving them hay. It's a really flat-out full-time job. Like you're probably spending 6, 7 hours just starting the day by doing all of that. And then you're off to the races. Sometimes before that, you'll have to lose some weight. So everybody has their different methods. Back then, we had a sauna. My dad used to tell me his tricks that he used to use as a jockey. That was by putting on plastic basically all over your body. You could have a sweatsuit or even as much as a rubbish bag to draw the sweat out, go for a run until sweat's running down your face was his suggestion. And then he'd make me a bed with like four hot water bottles and you'd go under there and it's actually a bit of torture. But, you know, it's part and parcel of losing weight to gain the opportunities to have the ride. So I didn't know any different. I'd watch my older brothers and sisters and just went into that role.
Tell me about the ritual of walking the track that your dad passed on to you.
Something that he was really adamant about, and it wasn't huge back then. I remember walking the track and maybe one or two other jockeys or one or two other trainers would be out there. Now you see them all out there. They realise the significance of it. Dad really loved, I think, that you could have an edge, gain an advantage by putting in the extra effort and work.
So what does it tell you by going out to the racetrack before the race? What are you looking for? What do you learn?
Really basic is you're just looking for the fastest lane, fastest point of the track. When you walk a track, you are walking a track, if it's usually been rain affected. So if we've had a lot of rain and it's soft and muddy on the inside, the horses have churned it up, sometimes that can just slow you right down and you might want to be shifted to about 4 metres off the track where it's fresh ground, and it's basically like a conveyor belt in a way, because you're running on a track, part of the track that's just really clean and no holes or divots. So it's really intriguing and interesting, because at the same time you might have a horse that absolutely flourishes through the softer ground and doesn't matter if it's been churned up, and the shortest way home is the best way. So it's really, I think, one of the parts that I love about racing is the tactical side of things and weighing that all up, especially when you aren't getting the best rides always. You know, you're not given the opportunities that are going to give you the best chance. You need to find out how you can overcome that. If your horse isn't quite as good, you might have an edge in another way. And so many times that was the difference between winning and losing and getting more and more opportunities. So, yeah, I loved it. I love that side of things. I love that Dad taught us that.
Let's go to the morning of the first Tuesday in November in 2015. How were you feeling before the race?
I was feeling really calm, really ready. I had one ride in the Melbourne Cup 6 years earlier, my first ride as a 24-year-old for Bart Cummings, who was a Melbourne Cup legend, having trained 12 winners. I think having had that experience was huge, because it wasn't my first time out there. I knew the horse really well, Prince Penzance. I'd ridden him in 23 of his 24 starts before that day. I think it's really nice when you have a good connection with your horse. It just gives you that sense of comfort that you know them. So I was so excited, basically.
What were the betting odds on you going in?
So he was rated at 100 to 1, which kind of is a good in a way, because you don't have any pressure on you. I didn't really care either way if he was 20 to 1, 50 to 1. I just thought, who cares about the odds? I know the horse that I have.
Were there any other women jockeys that day?
No, that day was the only one. So I'd ridden in many races being the only female, so I wasn't too worried about that. I was just actually super excited to get out there and give it a go.
And from a jockey's point of view, what's the most challenging thing about the Melbourne Cup as a race?
Probably you just can't let the occasion get to you. It's great to be excited. You've got to live the moment. You've got to feel it. Honestly, it's the best thing in the world. Gaining a ride in our biggest race is unbelievable, but you have a job to do. So I think for me, being so prepared, mentally you'd done all the training you could, you'd crossed all the T's, dotted all the I's. Physically, I'd worked so hard to be so physically fit that I felt like no stone had been left unturned in that way. And then I had the horse and the barrier. So I think as a rider, you can get nervous if one of those things hasn't been done properly or you're not as prepared. The Melbourne Cup's also, you know, it's hectic. 24 runners all trying to find a position, the best position to give yourself every chance. So you have to be brave.
Your beloved brother Stevie was your strapper that day. So what was his role in the morning before the race?
So Stevie, basically, they go down, feed the horses, they saddle them up for training, everything. So he would have just done probably a shortened routine of that, as he had a big day ahead. go home, get his suit on. He didn't want to wear a tie, so he left the tie off. gets a bit tight around his collar, so he left that off. And basically they get to the races. The horse is there 3 hours beforehand. They do all the testing and everything. They put the horse in their stalls, which they've been allocated, keep them nice and calm, give them a brush, oil their feet. The trainer will saddle them up sort of an hour beforehand, 45 minutes beforehand, put the bridle on. They give them a walk sort of throughout the 3 hours to keep their muscles nice and soft and supple and warmed up, also while keeping them as calm as they can.
And so was Prince calm as you were let into the gates?
Prince was just perfect. He could get excited. He was just so in the zone. It was amazing. It was like everything had come together beautifully. Whether he sensed the occasion, I'm not sure, but I remember walking around the mountain, I think he just felt good, full of energy, but not bursting with energy, just nice and ready. We walked down the roses with Stevie and Maddie Raymond, who was Prince's regular strapper. Everybody was screaming, especially being the only female in the race, so loud, especially at one corner. I was actually signalling to them to shush because they were going to make him, you know, excited, but he didn't care. He took it all in. And that comes from us too. You have to stay calm, even as a rider. Your legs, you can't be feeling nerves or tension. They sense everything. And just patting to them, talking to them. Stevie let me go out onto the track and I'll never forget it because, you know, I was waiting for, you know, every time he would let me go, he'd just say good luck. Waiting for it, didn't say it, lets me go. I go to canter off. He yells out, "Don't get beat, I've got my money on you."
Take us back to that moment 10 years ago when the gates at Flemington crashed open. What happened next?
The very first step, he was asleep. He just took a walk and I was like, oh my God. I was like, oh, God, this is not the way we expected to begin. But, you know, there was 300 metres where we had the opportunity to hold our position behind the horse who finished second, Max Dynamite. And in that 300 metres, the whole field is thundering across getting their positions. And there was a real point where another rider in the race, Joe Moreira, who'd drawn barrier three, was getting pressure to push me into the rail. I either had to get in there really fast or get out of there. And it's that split second decision that you have to trust your instincts. And so I called to Joe, just quietly, "Joe, I'm on your inside." And
what, during the race, you call out to the other jockey?
Oh, of course. Yeah. He knew I was there, probably could sense me, but he wanted to know if I was going to stay there because he's got pressure, so he's got to be looking ahead as well. So you have to, by obligation, let them know that you're there. And he, of course, knew I wanted to hold my position if I could. And again, I called to him just to make sure he knew definitely I was there. And he looked and he held his position straight and, you know, held his line off the fence and we were able to get up inside him.
And then what about that moment where you saw a gap that you could take on the home stretch?
The first gap that really was the next move to either being winning or losing move was around the sort of 1,200, 1,400 metre mark. So it's a fair way from the finish line. But these are the situations where you have to trust your judgment, trust, you know, years of riding and races, all those scenarios you've been in. So at that point, a run presented where Darren had told me to follow the second horse, Max Dynamite, until the top of the straight, which is about the 500 metre mark. At this point, after watching all the replays of the Melbourne Cup where the horses generally win from, I thought, no, I have to get off the fence here. The speed has been really slow. Horses usually, when they go slow up front, sprint really fast and it's hard to make that ground. But we got into a beautiful flowing position behind the horse that was the second favourite, Trip to Paris. And you really want to be following a horse that's got a good chance because they take you further. So we got onto his back and I was getting really excited because I knew the horse that I had in Prince Penzance and he was travelling so well. He felt so good. So, yeah, it was just a matter then of staying composed because so many jockeys lose and win a race by getting excited, the occasion gets to them. I knew that, and that's where I really said to myself, you really need to stay in this moment here. Don't get excited. I know it's the Melbourne Cup, but it's all just another race as well, so you have to treat it that way. So we stayed on the back of him for as long as we could, and I didn't want to make any contact with another runner. You know, you bump into another horse, it affects your horse's stride, their ability to quicken, so we just needed to keep it smooth. And at the top of the straight, I started to move to the outside of Trip to Paris to just make sure nothing had come around me, put me in a pocket. And, just waited, honestly, that 150 metres of waiting from the 450 to the 300, which is where we really let everything go full ball, was just so exciting, exhilarating. And then giving Prince everything from that 300 metre mark and hitting the front, sort of 200 to go, was just an out-of-body experience. Unbelievable.
Is it as vivid in your mind now, 10 years on, Michelle?
Of course, yeah. I could honestly take you through every step of the race. You're so in the zone, you're so focused that it's just, yeah, it's stuck there.
You were then, of course, surrounded, you know, swarmed by excited well-wishers and reporters. Had you prepared a speech for if you won?
Funnily enough, the night before, I'd never want to get, you know, ahead of yourself, go the early crow. But I was lying in bed and I was like, if we won, because you're in it to win it, of course. And I didn't think we were 100 to 1 chance. I thought, who do I want to thank? I don't want to forget anybody's name who helped us to get there that day. Obviously all the owners, the people behind the scenes in the stables at Darren Weir's, Darren Weir himself, the horse, obviously. So I did. I thought, I really want to make sure I get that right.
Where did the great moment of Get Stuffed come from? Was that spontaneous or had you had that tucked away in the back of your mind as well?
Honestly, at that point, it was about my fifth interview in about 7 minutes. Everybody was so crazy and I think I thought, you know, this is pretty special. First female jockey, I'd never thought of it before then. And I thought, you know what, we've just won our greatest race. It's the perfect time to get up and say something to all the people who, you know, put you down, you're in a big race. They say, oh, you should have put a guy on your horse. You have a better chance. It was a perfect time, I felt, to say something.
So what do you remember of the days and weeks after that win? What was life like?
Oh, God, it was just a whirlwind. My feet didn't touch the ground, honestly. I didn't even get to watch the race, the replay of the race, until midnight that night when I got home and ordered a pizza. I hadn't had any dinner. I didn't even have a drink because I was so excited. I just thought, if I have a drink now, I'm not going to last the week. So everybody was at the pub celebrating and I just had a water, got home at midnight, ordered a pizza, watched the replay. So that was pretty special by myself. Had a huge morning the next day, 35 interviews set up at 6:30 at the local golf course, followed by an interview at the Crown Casino at a ladies' lunch, followed by a helicopter ride to the races where I was riding in the Kyneton Cup. It just was the biggest whirlwind you could have ever imagined.
And, of course, you were still racing. And only a few months after the Melbourne Cup win, you were racing at Mildura. And what sound did you hear at around the 700-metre mark?
My horse had clipped heels of another horse and tripped it. She didn't fall, but she stumbled really badly and threw me over her head. And I tried to hold on and get myself back on, but unfortunately I was too far gone and fell underneath her, so she stood on me. They usually try to miss you if they can.
And how big is this horse? Like, what sort of weight?
We're in a 500, 600 kilo animal. So she stood on my stomach, which now I look back and think, how lucky, you know. A matter of inches, it can stand on your chest, stand on your heart, could be killed. But thankfully for me, she stood a bit further down and she stood on like my stomach area and liver. She lacerated my stomach, lacerated the liver. But at the back is your pancreas and that can't move out of the way. Both of the others, you know, shifted, but that was sort of stuck and explained to me that it severed it. 3/4 of my pancreas was severed off in the fall.
You wouldn't have known any of that at the time. You would have just been in enormous pain. Yeah. Were you conscious?
I had no idea. So I think I was initially knocked out and then came to on the track. And I remember it must have been pretty early because they hadn't got me on the stretcher yet. And I was saying to them, I was rolled up in a ball. I said, you can't move me. I'm bleeding internally. I don't know what's happened, but something's really wrong. And they were like, we need to get you onto the stretcher. I was like, you can't move me. I'm bleeding. If you flatten me out, you're going to tear it more. I don't know how I knew that, but I could just feel it. So for 45 minutes, they had me on the track trying to get me onto this stretcher. And they had another ambulance came. They gave me a lot of morphine and they eventually got me stretched out. And I was lying in the ambulance there ready to go to the hospital. And I was just lying there, obviously pretty dazed from the amount of morphine that they gave me, and started to think to myself, I feel like I won a big race last year, but for the life of me, I could not remember what it was. I didn't want to ask anyone because I was like, I feel like it's happened. But anyway, I was sitting there and I asked them for my phone. They gave me my phone and Googled my name because I didn't know what else to Google. And it came up the Melbourne Cup and I was like, oh, my God, not just any race, the best one. So, yeah, I felt pretty lucky, got to win the race twice. So it was a pretty special feeling. But, the recovery of that was just unbelievably painful.
Why did you tell the doctors and nurses that you needed to get up and walk?
To be honest, I was really struggling to cope. The pain of it was unbelievable. I spent, I think, the second night in ICU because the amount of tramadol and painkillers they had me on was sending me into a hallucination. I couldn't even make out the nurses. Everything was just orange and swirling. I was basically completely out of it. So they had to come up with another plan, and that was to put an epidural in my back to numb the area as best they could. It did something, but not much, to be honest. I was basically praying to God to help me get through the pain every day. And eventually when I could get up to go to the bathroom, I said, can I just go for a walk? Because lying in bed was killing me. So I had to get up and just try to take away the boredom and just the constant feeling of the pain. So I started to, after they gave me the all clear, I started to walk some laps of the ward with my trolley of all the tubes that were coming out of me. Basically, it's just one step after the other, and I'd walk laps and see all the patients wave hey, and like a lot of them couldn't get up, and I know how hard that was to see that I could, but the ones that could were like, can we join you? So I was like, sure, no worries. And they obviously asked the nurses and the doctors, and in the end I had six or seven people just walking around this ward with me, and it's really a daze for me because, I was on so much medication and stuff, but an unbelievable, feeling that my way of coping could help other people as well.
And your dad's a big walker. He's always been a big walker too, hey?
He is. So my dad had a quadruple bypass, and his way of coping with that was that he'd go for a walk. So maybe I, learnt that off him, I suppose.
After the gravity of that injury, and of course having had this pinnacle of winning the Melbourne Cup, there was a lot of pressure on you to retire. What kept you racing after that?
Probably the fact that it was very sudden. When you have a fall, it's a real shocking experience, and you're not prepared for it. The day before I fell, I'd just ridden Prince Penzance in a race in Adelaide. He was having one run before having a rest to then prepare again for another Melbourne Cup the next year. He went terrific, honestly, run out of his skin. It was unbelievable. So he was really in good form, good shape to come back and take on the cup again. And so I guess that was in the back of my mind. I had ridden two winners that day, had a great day to start with. You're not prepared. Shit, my life's changed now. So I just wanted to relax, just try to get better, not even think about it at that point. And the pressure was amazing. I got outside of the hospital when I was released to go home, and there was 50 reporters there, cameras everywhere. Are you going to retire? I was like, I haven't even given it a second thought. My health is my main concern at the moment. I'd lost sort of 6 kilos in 2 weeks because I couldn't eat anything. And already as a jockey, you're very, very light and skinny. So the main concern was just to get better. So I just got home, went to my dad's. Again, they were lined up out the front of dad's for an interview. And we just, go in, go out. Each day they were there. Quite an extraordinary thing to live through when you're just, in pain and recovering. So
what advice did your dad have for you?
My dad's very level-headed and, just right to the point. And he's like, oh, well, you just got to recover and you don't need to make a decision right now. You're here. I think, you're still alive, so anything's possible. And, he's pretty matter-of-fact sort of a guy and, run the risk raising all of us kids and letting us sort of work things out along the way. And it teaches you common sense. You learn to get through different situations because sometimes it might be a bit of a do or die kind of thing. But yeah, in a way that has taught us a lot.
When it did finally come time for you to retire, how was it that horses actually seemed to be telling you, giving you the nudge that it was time?
Over the years of riding, I'd had a lot of concussions following a fractured skull, and it had been a worry because, you know, we don't know so much about CTE, and always that was in the back of my mind. But every fall I came back, I felt good and recovered and able to, you know, do day-to-day things, no problem, think well, ride in a race, no problem. So I didn't see the reason to not continue on. So at this stage, I wasn't riding a lot. Training, I had a dual license, riding and training in races, and loving it because, you know, you're working with these horses every day. You then get to go compete on them. You've got the owners behind you. So fun. You know, you're really running your own race. And I think as a rider, I was even better because I got to trust my judgment in a better way without the pressure. So I was really loving that. But yeah, just had three in about 3 months that were my own horses at home, quiet. One of them just shot at a bird and she threw her head up really suddenly and whacked me in the head just above my eyebrow and gave me two black eyes and I thought, oh, she's broken my nose, but she hadn't. Knocked me around a bit. So that was fine. I continued riding, wasn't too bad, but probably in some way had a concussion, but you've got a business to run. So I just pretty much soldiered on through that. And I think it was a week later, I had another horse. He just got a fright and spun around quickly and same thing, just whacked me in the nose and gave me a blood nose this time. And again, I was a bit sort of dazed by it. It really knocked me hard. They've got a very hard point between their ears, which is called the poll. It's basically a bone. So if you get hit by that, which both of them did, it's, you know about it. So yeah, those two knocks to the head really sort of worried me. And I was starting to struggle a bit, you know, just tired, headaches. But at the same time, again, still had a business to run. So I was continuing riding track work and running that each day. These all happened within 2 to 3 months, and another horse did a very similar thing, she went to buck. Just a young horse got a fright and was feeling too well, and when she went to buck, she threw her head down but then threw it back up suddenly, and same thing with the pole, the strongest part, hit me in the nose really hard and really dazed me, and I felt that one, and I think the three of them together, just nasty, you know, I guess concussions, really knocked me around, and I was struggling then after that day to day to continue training, and I sort of really felt I can't go on doing this, especially with all the hype of everything else. So took a little step back, asked my brother Patrick if he could give me a hand, which, you know, it's not a real lovey-dovey brother, but he's very caring, and he said, look, just give them to me for a couple of months and, you know, you might change your mind, you might feel better. It's a tough job. I've been there myself, you know. You think, do you want to keep doing this life, or, you know, do you want to try something else? So he was very calm and relaxed about it, and I was really appreciative of that because, you know, work really hard with these young horses, the owners, the business that you've built, and you don't want to just give that all away in a heartbeat, but you've also got to listen to your body. So just came to the decision that maybe, you know, I should hang the boots up. It was time. Lives through a lot of falls, a lot of injuries, and you got to listen to your body and what you're in. So become pretty clear that that was the time. And I was, you know, a bit sad, obviously. You're giving away a passion and what you love. But at the same time, you have to be realistic.
You've experienced a whole bunch of injuries during your career riding, Michelle. Like, are you sometimes amazed at what your body's been able to recover from?
Absolutely. I think one thing I've learned through all of them, you obviously take each one as they come. First one was fractured skull, which is probably a pretty big one to take on first up. And then I had a dislocated ankle, fractured my neck, had to wear a neck brace for sort of 3 months, and then had many other fractured vertebrae through different falls, fractured my neck again. You know, each one you just deal with at the time, but to think each time you come back to riding, sometimes I think I probably didn't do the physio that I was suggested to do and just sort of took it a bit for granted. And there's times where you're in a lot of pain and you could give up. But I think one word of advice that I can give is that your body is unbelievable and amazing if you give it the time and the energy and the effort that it deserves. And after, you know, having so many headaches and back pain and lower back pain, I was thinking, you know, is this going to be my life forever? But investigating it further, getting help, even if it doesn't work the first time with somebody, try again. I sit here in not much pain considering the amount of falls. I've a lot of trouble with my hips because, you know, you're running in and you know, it's not a natural position as a jockey, you know, squatting down for all that time, but not through a fall. But through the falls, I'm 100% recovered and feel great. So I think it's really one lesson to learn. And yeah, well, my one word of advice is don't give up. If something's not working, continue to try other things.
You know, there's the risk that horse racing poses to riders, and then, of course, there's the risk to horses as well. And it seems like over the last few years, there's been a bit of a sea change in the way that horse racing as an industry is viewed by many people, particularly young people. Does that make you think differently about the future of this world that you've been a part of your whole life?
I think that all we can do for us in the racing industry is just promote it for what we see it as, which is beautiful. These animals basically are treated so beautifully behind the scenes, which people don't see. Obviously, there are athletes, so any athlete has to be pampered, has to be given the best possible opportunity to perform at their best, race at their best. But with that, they need to be comfortable in themselves. They've got to be relaxed, happy, feeling good. So they're massaged, they're swum, they're in spas. It's actually something that I think we can continue to do more as an industry, is promote how good it is behind the scenes, because people see, you know, the tragedies and the things that make what racing is bad, that's first and foremost. And the people that are the most heartbroken are the participants that are with these horses every day. You know, they're part of the family. We love them. So hopefully we can just continue to educate people behind the scenes, because at the end of the day, that's what we see racing for and why we love it so much.
Michelle, your family suffered another really terrible loss this year. You lost your sister Bernadette to suicide in March. I'm really sorry. How are you doing now as a family a few months on?
Obviously, it was a real tragic time, not just the time but the lead up. We could probably comfortably say 15 years before that. So it was just a train of events that we tried to do our best. You tried to learn from many family meetings, interventions, quite a few dramatic occasions. And I think just the hardest thing at the end was we couldn't help. I think maybe the only chance we had was to catch it earlier. And I think that's one thing we can say to anybody, any family. You know, you want to sit back, but at some point you've got to really look at the situation for what it is and think, do we need to step in here? You know, you obviously have that respect for a person's privacy and everything, but as a family and you're caring, you know, our suggestion would be just to really step in. There's so many ways of doing that, with counsellors, psychologists, get all the, you know, advice you can get. Because, yeah, like I said, in the end, we just felt helpless. There's a lot of us. We could have supported her in any way, but unfortunately we just didn't know how to. And, yeah, the months after it, you couldn't even believe it, you know, that emptiness, that feeling. I think one of the most beautiful legacies that Bernie left behind was everybody was looking out for each other more, so she would be happy about that.
Is that what's helped most with this grief, is the support of your siblings and your dad?
I think, obviously, yeah, being a big family, there's always somebody to talk to. Everybody has a different perspective, a different take on it. I think that's beautiful, because you can really learn from each person's personality, each person's way of coping with a tragedy. My dad, of course, is the, you know, leader of the bunch, and he is so strong. You know, obviously losing my mum, losing my next sister, Bridgie, which was so unbelievably tough for him to lose his first child. You know, you look up to them and you look at how they cope. So his strength is incredible. He's not a drinker. He just sits at home, fiddles with his thumbs, sits there thinking about things, pondering about life. But like I said, everybody then became much more connected in the fact that we, you know, checking in on each other, you know, probably just more aware. And I think if Bernie was around to see that or looking down on us, it would make her really happy. So she did leave behind a beautiful legacy.
Can horses be a comfort, the relationship you have with horses, when life's really tough like that?
Oh, definitely, yeah. You know, just be, if you, anybody who has anything to do with him, you just walk out there and just their, just the sense of having them around, and they're just so beautiful. They just wander up to you, nuzzle you, and just, you know, give them a pat. There's nothing more calming or beautiful about that.
What about your big brother, Stevie, who became almost as much of a star as you did after your Melbourne Cup win? What's he up to these days?
So Stevie lives with my dad, which is probably about 2 km down the road from where I live. We own the farm that I live on together, and we've been slowly sort of working on that farm, building things. It started off as one big bear paddock, so there's always plenty to do, and it's a really healthy lifestyle to be on the farm, being out a part of nature. We obviously have the horses. We just bought some little calves that we're raising. We have some cows. It doesn't get any better than being out day to day working with him. You know, you're out mowing lawns, you're doing stuff together. You have little jobs, little missions that you want to do, building things. We just absolutely love it. So he's enjoying that. He's just actually met a girl that now is his girlfriend. So they're getting along very well. They have plenty of conversations on FaceTime. She lives in Melbourne, so they're making it work through that. And it's just absolutely gorgeous.
And how are you going to mark this 10th anniversary of your Melbourne Cup win?
So Stevie's coming to the Melbourne Cup this year. And as just as a guest, so first time I think you can really sit down, have lunch, enjoy it. Kathy's girlfriend's coming along. Her sister is joining them, and my partner Gabrielle. So it's going to be really nice to have them special people there, such a special day.
How do you feel about it? How does that anniversary feel for you?
Amazing. I can't wait for the day. Like, it's going to be quite emotional and sentimental, I guess. I didn't cry on the day of the Melbourne Cup, but who knows, you know, 10 years on, a lot's happened. It's definitely on the cards.
Michelle, it's been really wonderful to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
Michelle Payne was my guest on Conversations today, and Michelle's new book is called Ride On. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.